Yeah, Andy Valver from Deutsche Welle, who's relatively new to this climate process and press stuff. But I mean, can you put it into terms, or like when I'm here at these conferences, I hear really a lot of jargon, okay? And taking that back to the newsroom and trying to make some sense of it to lay people who have not been involved in this huge, long process. Any one of you can take this question, and I would just say, just give me a short little rap, something that I can use in plain English to talk to the rest of the world about what happened here this week.
So what we're doing right now is to try and sort out that spaghetti, to make sure that we can make sense of this is spaghetti, this is a meatball, this is tomato sauce, and then when we know what's what, then we'll be able to actually make a course out of it that can be eaten.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where this week we're making it our mission to tell you as much as we can in plain English about what happened at the UN climate talks in Bonn last week. The UN talks in Copenhagen at the end of the year, where the world hopes to sign a new global deal that would save us from the worst ravages of climate change, are part of an ongoing process that is unfolding right now. The talks in Bonn earlier this month were part of this process, and with those talks over, there are just three more negotiating weeks to go before the 2 weeks of talks begin in Copenhagen on the 7th of December. So was any progress made by the end of the latest meeting in Bonn? The most popular overall assessment seemed to be that yes, some progress had been made, but the progress had been slow and significant stumbling blocks remained. Here's Anders Thyresen of the European Union delegation.
But there are real stumbling blocks, of course, and the ultimate issues is who should do what, I guess. First of all, we need to agree on what we should do collectively. And there is no universal agreement on that so far. If we can agree on that, we have to share that burden. And we have to acknowledge that different countries have different circumstances. We have the principle of common but differentiated responsibility and respective capabilities. I think that principle says actually very well what it's all about. We have to define our respective responsibilities. So that is, of course, a big stumbling block. Moreover, and of course connected to this, we have the financial issue. There is a bill connected to this, and who should pay for what and to whom? That is an important issue. Beside these, there are all sorts of technical issues that all of them can constitute huge problems of various sorts. It is a very complex matter. It is, I mean, after all, what we are talking about is profound change of the industrial civilization. It is not a small thing we are trying to achieve together, so it would be surprising if there weren't stumbling blocks and conflicts of interest in these negotiations.
So let's take the first issue. What should we do collectively? What will the shared vision of the Copenhagen deal be? Anders says there is no agreement on that. Actually, since discussions are taking place under the umbrella of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, all parties are already signed up to the Convention's ultimate objective of avoiding dangerous climate change. So the discussion now is really about what constitutes dangerous climate change. A rise of 2 degrees centigrade in global average temperature compared to pre-industrial times? 1.5 degrees centigrade? 1 degree centigrade? The Obama-convened Major Economies Forum in June agreed that global average temperature rise must not exceed 2 degrees centigrade, and this has been widely trumpeted as progress. However, the 2 degrees C target was chosen by the European Union 13 years ago in 1996 after the second report on the climate science by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. A lot has changed since then, and the science is now clear that significant risks and impacts are likely to occur at even lower temperature thresholds. At a presentation in June in Brussels, the vice chair of the IPCC suggested that maybe it was time for the European Union to revise the 2 degrees C threshold in the light of the latest IPCC report. Here's how Jean-Pascal van Ypersele put his suggestion to the European Union in the presence of the European Commissioner on the Environment, Stavros Dimas.
So, and I'm sorry, Mr. Commissioner, for creating maybe some trouble here. I will try to stay policy relevant, because the IPCC cannot be policy prescriptive, so I will only ask a question. And the question is, 13 years, exactly 13 years actually, after the European Council of Ministers of June 96 decided on the basis of the second IPCC report, not even the third one, even less the fourth one, that dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system meant do everything possible not to go above 2 degrees above pre-industrial, the question is, shouldn't that target be reassessed today in the light of the impacts associated and the range of impacts associated to that temperature?
This presentation was given during the opening session of the European Union's Green Week conference back in June. By the end of Green Week, the European Commissioner on the Environment, Stavros Dimas, was agreeing that 2 degrees C was out of date and that the threshold should now be set at 1.5 degrees C.
2 degrees that we are aiming at, not to exceed 2 degrees, again, is not enough in order to avert negative, catastrophic and irreversible impacts from global warming. So we should limit the increase of temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Let's hear that again.
2 degrees that we are aiming at, not to exceed 2 degrees, again, is not enough in order to avert negative, catastrophic and irreversible impacts from global warming. So we should limit the increase of temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Earlier this year, I asked Malte Meinshausen, a respected scientist who has been the lead author on a number of important studies, about the 2 degrees target. He indicated that while it may have been useful in guiding policy in the past, the 1.5 degrees C target put forward by the Association of Small Island States might provide a more appropriate guide in the light of our current knowledge.
Scientists never said that 2 degrees is safe, but scientists said that if you move beyond 2 degrees, then in general we anticipate impacts that can be considered unsafe by every clear-thinking human being. So I think science can flesh out the impacts, can flesh out what are the thresholds that we are going to trigger at various points when we increase global mean temperatures. And it's up to the politicians to make the choice of where actually dangerous climate change starts. And I think it has become clear over the last couple of years as well that 2 degrees is not necessarily a safe level. There will certainly be, and there are already today, dramatic impacts that are linked to human-induced climate change. So the target is of the European Union helped to galvanize and to focus the process immensely. It helped to focus research. It helped to focus action, etc. We cannot say it's a safe level, and there are other targets now out there by the small island states of 1.5 degrees that might have, even with the most dramatic actions on mitigation, a lesser chance of being in the end achieved, like only around 50%, but in the end would avoid the impacts that I think the majority of people would like to see being avoided.
As the week of talks ended in Bonn, the balance swung in favour of the 1.5 degrees C target as the Association of Small Island States came together with the least developed country bloc representing between them over 80 countries in support of this safer target. The Obama-convened Major Economists Forum, by contrast, does not act as a negotiating bloc within the UN talks, and only comprises 39 countries. Here's Decima Williams, speaking for the Small Island States, or AOSIS, at their joint press conference with the Least Developed Countries, or LDCs, at the end of the week in Bonn, giving her assessment of the current position of the talks.
On behalf of the Alliance of Small Island States, AOSIS, I want to express our disappointment with the current lack of progress and ambition in the climate change talks. The pledges made by industrial countries to date add up to emissions reductions in the range of 10 to 16% below 1990 levels by 2020. Unless these pledges are strengthened, this will lead to global warming in excess of 3 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Such a path would be catastrophic for all countries, but especially for small island developing states. AOSIS continues to call for industrialized countries to collectively reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by at least 45% below 1990 levels by 2020, and for long-term temperature increases to be stabilized at well below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This will require global emissions to peak by 2015 and to fall quickly thereafter to ensure that global emissions in totality are reduced to at least 85% below 1990 levels by 2050. This would make it possible to return atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations to below 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent, which would give our islands the best chance for survival. This approach is realistic because it is risk-averting, it is precautionary, and it is problem-solving. Adverse climate change impacts are already being felt with a temperature increase of 0.8 degrees Celsius above industrial levels. Further temperature increases will only aggravate and accelerate the impacts already occurring, especially in the world's most vulnerable island countries. Current adverse impacts include sea level rise, ocean acidification, coral bleaching, land loss, coastal erosion, floods, desertification, drought, loss of freshwater supplies, biodiversity loss, and more frequent and intense extreme weather events, including hurricanes and king tides. The warming so far has already led the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to declare in a submission to the UNFCCC that some particularly low-lying states, and I quote, are likely to become entirely uninhabitable. We cannot continue to ignore the human costs of climate change. These are unnecessary loss of human life, hunger, disease, poverty, and lost livelihoods. All are already at our doorsteps. They have the potential to threaten social well-being and political stability, and in some cases, the very survival of low-lying island states and coastal regions. In these negotiations, we need far more ambitious reduction targets to ensure the survival of small island states and low-lying coastal areas around the world, and to boost our overall and well-tested resilience. Reducing emissions is everybody's business, everybody's obligation, and everybody's interest. And many of the necessary tools for doing this are already available. Recent studies show that the cost for developed countries of achieving a 40% reduction by 2020 is as low as 0.5 to 1.5% of GDP by 2020. Not a lot. This is a small price to pay when compared with the skyrocketing human and financial costs for developing countries to adapt to climate change. Developing countries are already reducing the growth of our emissions, but we are concerned that the lack of progress on quantifying the financial resources that will be available to assist vulnerable countries in responding to climate change. Developing countries need financial support of at least 1% of the industrialized world's GDP, which is approximately about $400 billion annually, in addition, of course, to current development assistance. The total finance currently available for climate change and climate-related projects is estimated at less than $10 billion a year. So far, less than $1 billion has been made available to address the urgent needs for adaptation. We believe that upcoming events in late September, including the United Nations Secretary General's high-level event on climate change and discussions on climate finance, are crucial opportunities for the announcement of higher targets on both the mitigation and adaptation financing levels. In advance of these events, EOSIS will hold a high-level summit in New York on September 21st. High on the agenda will be the targets that I've spoken about today. Scientists are telling us that the window of opportunity is closing quickly if we want to prevent disastrous and even catastrophic climate impacts. To respond to this mounting threat, we need to see the leadership and the ambition that is often claimed in the media reflected in the negotiating room. The reduction of targets put forward so far are so low as to risk, as I said earlier, a 3 degree of temperature increase. Clearly, we need to see progress on the negotiations and in particular the negotiating texts. We need to see finance proposals put on the table. Climate change diplomacy now must more fully embrace the science-based human dimension of the climate problem, well beyond, in fact, well before the strictly economic calculations being made. Ambitious targets are the first step in this direction. Our negotiations leading to and concluding in Copenhagen is the last chance for us to avoid a global human tragedy.
That was Ambassador Decima Williams of Grenada, Chair of the Association of Small Island States, speaking at a joint press conference with the least developed countries at the end of the talks in Bonn a couple of weeks ago, where they both announced their support for the 1.5 degree C target. If a Copenhagen deal is to be scientifically robust, the talks have no option but to move increasingly in the direction of this emerging consensus. Global emissions peaking before 2015, temperature rise kept as far below 1.5 degrees C as possible, and greenhouse gas concentrations kept well below 350 parts per million CO2 equivalent. How much longer can the EU cling to its outdated target of 2 degrees C, when its own Environment Commissioner recognises that it is dangerously inadequate? If the EU comes on board, there will be a clear majority amongst the 192 parties in Copenhagen for the 1.5 degrees C target. Although many African nations are part of the least developed country bloc, the African bloc of 50 countries as a whole does not support even the 2 degrees C target. Judging from what they were saying at their own press conference, this seems to be due to two reasons. First, they need to see funds on the table to enable any greenhouse gas cuts that they are required to make. Quite rightly, they don't want to be suffering further from bearing additional costs for climate change action. And they are supported in this stance by Article 4.7 of the UN Climate Convention, which makes clear that poor country actions are dependent on finance and technology transfer from rich countries. And secondly, they just don't trust the rich countries to do what they say. And from past experience, they have every right to adopt this position too.
Thank you, Alistair Dodd from Reuters. We heard from the group of LDCs and the EOSIS just now that they've teamed up to call for a 1.5 degree Celsius temperature limit and other issues. So is this supported by the African group as a whole?
The African group has its own position on that, and African group can go along with 2 degrees. The problem for 2 degrees for the African group is with regard not just these 2 degrees and 450 ppm, but the problem is the shared vision on that. We'll have the problem how these 2 degrees, how the responsibility to mitigate for these 2 degrees, how this will be shared among all parties. Are we going to be supported financially, technologically to mitigate? But the problem is the historical responsibility here. What we are suffering now until around 20, 40 or 50, this the responsibility of developed countries. It's around a century of industrialization of the developed world. It's what for we are having this raise of temperature, and it's not our responsibility at all. It's what for it will be very difficult to share this when we are not supported financially and technologically. Thank you.
Mama.
Thank you. I would like to add that there is a problem of trust in this area. As you all remember, in the convention, developed countries were asked to bring the level of their emission in 2000 at the level of 1990, but no one respected that. And so far, regarding the pledges, although IPCC has been very clear that the reduction should be between 25% and 40%. The pledges so far for developed countries range between 10% and 16% of reduction. So we are, there is a real problem that, when at least we agree on something, we should comply with. And I can multiply the examples regarding the financing. In the previous session, we gave the example of LDCF, the Least Developed Country Fund, where out of 2 billion needs, we have less than 200 million. There is a real problem in this process, because I am personally convinced that the developed countries are not willing to respect, to comply with their commitments. Sorry.
If the rich countries come on board with adequate finance for mitigation and adaptation and take real action towards the rapid decarbonisation of their own societies, that could overcome the African bloc's reasons for not coming on board with the shared vision of 1.5 degrees C. At that point, we'll just be left with the minority of rich countries that make up the rest of the so-called Annex 1 group, such as the US, Canada, Australia, Japan, Russia, and New Zealand. So once we've agreed on a shared vision that is informed by the latest science, what do we need to do next? Here's Anders Thuresen of the EU delegation again to remind us.
First of all, we need to agree on what we should do collectively. If we can agree on that, we have to share that burden, and we have to acknowledge that different countries have different circumstances. We have the principle of common but differentiated responsibility and respective capabilities. I think that principle says actually very well what it's all about. We have to define our respective responsibilities. So that is, of course, a big stumbling block. Moreover, and of course connected to this, we have the financial issue. There is a bill connected to this. And who should pay for what and to whom?
So the next step is to agree a fair way to share greenhouse gas emissions cuts and a fair basis for deciding who pays the bill. as contraction and convergence proponent Aubrey Mayer has argued tirelessly for many years, a principle-based solution is the most likely to achieve agreement and be fair. A number of principle-based solutions are being floated, and from my current understanding, the greenhouse development rights and climate debt approaches seem to be the fairest. We'll come back to look at this in more detail in a future programme, but for now, let's remind ourselves how badly the current bottom-up approach, favoured by many rich countries, including the US, is failing us. Here's Sarah Shaw from Tier Fund.
Targets. Let's look at them. I mean, it's absolutely terrible, really, what's on the table. Things have actually got a little bit worse since June. There was some analysis done in June, which came up with some figures of where Annex 1 parties were. There was a bit more done this time, and it's got worse since then. So on the basis of what the UNFCCC Secretariat is saying, we're looking at 13 to 21% cuts. But actually, AOSIS have done some analysis that says it's only 10 to 16% cuts. That's so far below the 25 to 40% ranges in the IPCC. That's far below the kind of more than 40% cuts that we need. It's pretty shocking. And it makes a bit of a mockery of the G8 and MEF statements about a two-degree deal and about a commitment to 2 degrees. Because these pledges, these targets clearly are incompatible with any kind of two-degree scenario. So we're pretty horrified by the targets that have been put out there. We're worried about the bottom-up approach to working them out. That's not a scientific way of doing things. And we're really worried about the fact that there is no real serious finance on the table to engage developing countries in achieving mitigation actions either. And I think we're also really worried that some of the rules might be sort of cooked up in a certain way that leaves emissions reductions being counted in more than one place, that leaves finance for reductions being counted in more than one place. And that sounds like a boring point, but actually the overall integrity of the deal that we get in Copenhagen will be determined by that kind of thing. So ultimately, I think we're left asking the question, what kind of degree rise are Annex 1 countries looking at? Do they want a 4-degree world, a 5-degree world, a 6-degree world? Because the level of ambition at the moment is nowhere near enough. Thank you.
In Bonn, we saw further evidence of how well this approach is working, as New Zealand joined the ranks of the rich world, who have come forward with planet-wrecking unilateral targets. If there was a global deal they announced, they would be able to offer emissions reductions of just 10 to 20%. This target came with a raft of further conditions, including credits for their forests and full access to offsets in the developing world. Russia too confirmed that it would reduce emissions by 10 to 15%, below 1990 levels by 2020. But since Russian emissions were already 34% below 1990 levels in 2006, their target actually represents an increase on current emissions in the order of 30%. The Association of Small Island States have formally tabled their proposal that rich countries make a combined cut in their emissions of 45% by 2020 compared to 1990 levels. But it is not clear from their proposal that there is any limit on how much of those targets can be met by purchasing offset credits from poor countries. India, meanwhile, are asking for an 80% cut from rich countries by 2020, which I can only presume means that this is the kind of target that is appropriate if the rich world want to continue to count offsetting towards their domestic targets. In this programme, we focused on some of the big picture stuff, which is the prerequisite of an effective deal in Copenhagen. Time is fast running out for the rich world to come good on its long-standing commitments under the United Nations Climate Convention, without which there will be no effective and fair deal in Copenhagen. It's doable, but we need to see a major change in approach by the rich world, with the active engagement of finance ministers and heads of state. In a breakthrough moment earlier this week, the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Rajendra Pachauri, came out in a personal capacity in support of the 350 target. and there will be a major push to get the target in the public consciousness on the 24th of October, with a worldwide day of actions involving the number 350. In future programmes, we'll be looking at the other key building blocks of the global deal, which all need to be in place to realise the overall shared vision. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. You can feedback, sign up for our weekly email or our RSS feed, hear the show again, or get references relating to this week's programme by visiting the Climate Radio Archive at climateradio.org. And we end with a cautionary note from UNFCCC Secretary Ivo de Boer. Thanks for listening.
As Copenhagen approaches, I keep hearing those who say that we can delay action on climate change, that we can survive a rise of over 2 degrees temperature increase, that we can safely cut costs and safely cut corners, and that there are other priorities that we need to be focusing on. And I believe that this is the way to a global disaster. A climate change deal in Copenhagen this year is simply an unequivocal requirement to stop climate change from slipping out of control. And it would be incomprehensible if this opportunity were lost. In that sense, we cannot lose sight of the problem and recognize that serious climate change is equal to game over.